No? Okay, so then I guess we can continue where we left off yesterday, which was Shor's algorithm. So so remember, here's the basic circuit for Shor's algorithm. We start with kind of the main computational qubits in, oops, sorry, this is in the wrong place. We start by putting them in a superposition of everything. And then we calculate x to the a mod n and store the result in some auxiliary register. We can then measure the auxiliary register, which collapses the main computational states into superposition of, well, basically a periodic set of peaks, right? There's some particular value a0, which is just some value a0 that gives a particular measurement result here. And then we get the same measurement result periodically by adding, adding r, which is the order of a, of x. Find order r of x. Right? And I showed you at the end of class yesterday that if it happens that r divides 2 to the n, and you do this circuit, then you'll get something that's, when you do the Fourier transform, you'll get something that's peaked at multiples of 1 over r. And therefore, we can measure that and figure out exactly what r is. You know, assuming we happen to get a multiple that's relatively prime to the to R. Okay? Everyone remember that? It's only yesterday. Okay. So so today we have to go through some more details of Shor's algorithm. So for one thing, we need to resolve these big black boxes. How do you do the modular exponentiation in a reasonable amount of time? How do you do the Fourier transform in a reasonable amount of time? And I won't go through all the details, but I'd like to say something about how you deal with the fact that R is not, in general, going to be a divisor of 2 to the n. Okay. So I guess we can start with the modular exponentiation. We can dispose of that one pretty quickly. So the goal, given A, calculate x to the A mod n. OK? So the way we can do this is we can first pre-calculate. And this you can actually do classically. We know x mod n, so we can calculate x squared mod n. Right? And this requires one multiplication. And then once you know x squared mod n, you can calculate x to the fourth by squaring it. And then you can square again and get x to the eighth and x to the 16th, and so on. We can get up to x to the 2 to the little n. There's little n qubits here. Which is the biggest value of A that we could possibly have to deal with. Actually, you probably can do 2 to the n minus 1. But. OK. And then in general, if you have a general A, well, you can write A is equal to A0, 2 to the n minus 1, plus A1, 2 to the n minus 2, plus dot, 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 plus a n minus 1. And this is, of course, just the binary representation of a. And so then x to the a, well, you use this binary representation to say it's x to the 2 to the n minus 1 to the a0 plus x to the 2 to the n minus 2 to the a1 plus, sorry, not plus, times. Times dot, dot, dot. Well, x to the 0. No, x to the 1, sorry, to the a n minus 1. Right? It's just expanding this out. And well, a 0 and I 1, et cetera, they're just bits, 0, 1. So basically, this is saying we have to multiply together to calculate x to the a. This is, of course, all mod n. Calculate x to the a, we have to multiply together just the set of these powers of 2 exponents that appear in the binary expansion of a. Okay? So calculating each of these requires one multiplication from the last one. So let's say, so multiplication requires, well, again, if you do it the, you know, with log multiplication, it requires O of log n squared bits, operations. There's faster ways, fast multiplication. But let's just use this. And then, well, we have to do it n times, to, or little n times, actually. So we need, for all powers of 2, we need about O of n log n squared operations. And then multiplying these together, well, that's just adding on an amount, which is, again, n multiplications. The total then is O of n log n squared plus n log n squared. And the worst case is where you have a that's all ones, right? And so you have to include everything. Okay? And this, of course, this is a factor of 2, but that doesn't matter in this big O notation. So we have big O of n log n squared. Okay? So that's a polynomial time in the number of input bits, depending on what little n is, which we haven't decided yet. Okay? Everyone see that? Okay, this is the easy part. The Fourier transform is a little more subtle and is the real quantum part. So let's do that. Okay, so to work out the Fourier transform, well, first of all, what does it do? Let me remind you of that. I guess I wrote it yesterday, but so the Fourier transform, this is going to be the mod 2 to the n Fourier transform. So it takes a to sum over b omega to the a b b, where omega is the 2nth root of unity. 2 to the n, root of unity. OK? So how are we going to do this? Well, again, we're going to want to write a this way. And we'll write b that way, too. And then we can write this image here. Actually, I guess it should be 1 over square root of 2 to the n. There. Yeah. Sorry, a is anything.
The mode of expansion we're getting, if a is say 0 or 4, is
it? Oh, yeah, yeah. So, no, a, well, OK. So, yeah, so it's enough to consider just for a equals integers. The algorithm assumes that. I mean, right now we're not, the representation we're using only really writes integers from 0 to 3 to the n anyway. So. Okay. And similarly, Fourier transform, we're going to interpret this as an integer. I mean, you can reinterpret this, right, and say, well, we'll divide by 2 to the n, and then it's a number from 0 to 1. But it's a, you know, it's a rational with denominator 3 to the n. Since we're dealing with finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, you can only represent a finite set of numbers anyway. So what you want to call them is a bit arbitrary, but that's the inherent fact. So anyway, so let's write them as integers. And this will be A and this will be B, binary representations again. And so then if we look at this combination, well, we can rewrite that as, well, first of all, this B register we can expand out. And it turns out it's going to be most helpful to write it kind of backwards with the least significant bit first. And this WAB, then we can factor out into the part that involves BN minus 1 and the part and separate the BN minus 1 term and the part that involves BN minus 2 and separate that out and so on. So what do we get then? Well, the part that involves BN minus 1 is going to be, I guess, the sum over A has to go out front. No, sorry, there's no sum over A, sum over B. OK, so we can sum over BN minus 1. The force is going to be equal to 0 or 1. And so what's the coefficient that involves b to the n minus 1? Well, it's each of these multiplied by b to the n minus 1, which is omega to the a0 to the, I mean, in this case, it's all of a, plus a1 to the n minus 2, plus dot dot dot, plus a n minus 1. OK. So that's good. Now let's do the b to the n, b sub n minus 2 part. OK. So in this case, well, here, let me write it. Bn minus 2, 2 plus bn minus 1. So if you look at this product, a0, bn minus 2, it's times 2 to the n, right? And omega is a 2 to the nth root of unity. So if you do that, if you plug that in, you just get 1, right? You get 1 to the a0, bn minus 2. But that's still 1. Okay? So we can kind of ignore that term. And we only need to write this term and on. So we have a 1, 2 to the n minus 2, plus dot dot dot, plus a n minus 1, the n minus 2. Okay? And of course, we can keep on going like this. And each time we go to another bit of B, we need one fewer bit of A, right? Because we're getting one extra factor of 2 here. And so we get 2 to the n one place earlier in A. So the final term, B0, we only need to include this last one. So we get omega to the A n minus 1, B0. Times, sorry, 2 to the n minus 1, b0. And then b0. Okay? Yeah?
Are we multiplying here over, I mean, this summation over bn?
Sorry, this?
The last step.
This step.
So is that multiplication or addition?
It's tensor product, actually. Right, because each of these is a valid one qubit state. And we're saying that it's but this is, so this is what happens if you put in a tensor product state, a basis state, not just a general tensor product state. If you put a basis state in the input register, you actually get, yes, a tensor product state in the output. Yeah?
The last factor there, you have a to the a n minus 1 times 2 to the n minus 1.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so there's a factor of 2 in this b to the n. So this could have been b to the n minus 1. And then this last one here is a n minus 1 times 2. And then here, this 2 to the n minus 1 is coming from the b0. So it was this one that was wrong, actually, not this one.
OK. Sure,
OK. OK. So actually, this particular combination is going to be particularly interesting. So omega to the 2 to the n minus 1, that's equal to minus 1, right? Because that's e to the 2 pi I over 2, e to the pi I. So so actually, what this is saying, if you just looked at it in isolation, is the Hadamard transform of a n minus 1. Right? Because that's what the Hadamard transform does. It does a minus 1 to the a times b. In fact, the Hadamard transform is a special case of the Fourier transform when n is equal to 1. So in this class, QFT means quantum Fourier. OK? So that gives us a hint as to how we can make a circuit to do this. So if you look, you'll see, well, we have a 2 to the n minus 1 here and a 2 to the n minus 1 here. And there's going to be a 2 to the n minus 1 in every term. So each of these terms is going to involve a Hadamard transform. So basically, what's going to happen is this first qubit is going to be the Hadamard transform of a0. And the second qubit is the Hadamard transform of A1, and so on. Okay, except that then we have to do something to make all these phases work out right, these other phases. Okay, and those will involve different A's. But look, they're always later A's. So what does that mean in terms of a circuit? Well, so we start out. We start out with our A's. And in this case, we're going to write them in the regular order. Okay, and the B's are going to come out in the opposite order, right? Because here we have A0 and Bn minus 1, A1, Bn minus 2, and so on. And so we start out by doing a Hadamard transform here. And then we have to get all of these phases right. So to do that, we want to do conditional phase gates. And what does that mean? Well, to get this one right, we want to do a phase gate of omega to the 2 to the n minus 2, but only when both a1 and bn minus 1 are 1. So up here, we now have bn minus 1, right? Because we've done the Hadamard. And here we have a1 at the moment. Okay. So what we should do is we should do this gate. R to the pi over 2. Why pi over 2? Well, we have 2 to the n minus 2 here. So this is e to the 2 pi I over 4. And we do that conditional on this first qubit. Okay. So the way I'm writing it, I'm putting the phase up here. This particular phase gate is symmetric. It doesn't actually matter which is the control, which is the target. I just like to write it this way. Okay. But it has to involve both of these qubits. Okay? And then, of course, to do this one, well, I haven't written it here, but it's going to be a 2 to the n minus 3. So we're going to want to do a pi over 4 phase. And then we have to keep on doing that all the way down to the last one, which is going to be a pi over, I guess it's pi over 2 to the n minus 1. Yeah, let me make that bigger. Okay. Okay. So, and that gives us the first qubit. So that's what we want for the first qubit. But then we have to do the second qubit. So the second qubit, we're going to have to do a Hadamard transform. And then again, we have to get the phases. But again, they're all later phases. And the next one, remember, is going to be a2, 2 to the n minus 2 now, instead of a2, 2 to the n minus 3, as it was for here. So it's now a pi over 2 rotation. And we keep on doing that. Sorry. Dot. And here we get r pi over 2 to the n minus 2. Okay, and each time we do this, we're going to get another factor of 2 in the phases we do. So we just keep on doing this. And here we have r pi over 2 minus 3. And eventually, we get to the last qubit. And remember, in the last qubit, we just need to do the Hadamard transform. Just made it here. OK. Okay. And the outputs we get are going to be bn minus 1, bn minus 2, bn minus 3, through b0. OK? So it's worth noting that the order in which we do these phase gates in the Hadamard is very important, right? They don't commute with each other. And so in the first qubit, we had to do the Hadamard first, because we wanted to get this first qubit to be bn minus 1. So when we do these conditional phase gates, we're doing bn minus 1, not a0. And but on the other hand, we wanted to do multiplying an a and a b. So we needed to do these phase gates before we do the Hadamard. Okay. So that's how we do it, is we do the first qubit first, and we do all of those gates first. And then we move on to the second qubit and do all of those. And then the third qubit and do all of those, including all the phase gates and so on. OK? So does everyone understand this circuit? OK. Well, you'll get another crack at understanding it in the homework assignment. So if you don't understand it now, you'll have to understand it by then. Maybe. I don't know. It's possible that it may be possible to do the homework assignment without understanding it. It's certainly easier to understand. OK. So how many gates does this involve? Well, the first step involves n two-qubit gates. The second one involves n minus 1. The third involves n minus 2. So we have n plus n minus 1 plus dot 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 plus 1 for the last step, right? Which is going to be n plus 2. In other words, order n squared. OK? So good. So that's also efficient, provided n is not too big. I guess it's actually n plus 1. OK. So this is the full circuit then, putting this sketch together with the modular exponentiation and the Fourier transform. We put it together. We see that it requires, depending on how big little n is, either it's dominated by the modular exponentiation or the Fourier transform. Turns out the modular exponentiation is going to dominate, so it's going to require n log n squared operations. Okay? But now we have to deal with the fact that this state that we get before the Fourier transform is not perfectly periodic. Okay?
R does not divide.
Okay, so the reason it's not perfectly periodic then is because, well, when we get to here, we're counting up to 2 to the n anyway, right? And then once that happens, we go back to 0, right? This is all modular arithmetic. The Fourier transform has this 2 to the n in here, so it has an overall period of 2 to the n. When it starts to cycle. And our state, unfortunately, does not do that, because it starts, and we can imagine it starts at some value a0, has peaks every r placing. But then when we go over 2 to the n and go back to 0, we would get to somewhere else. Okay, and that doesn't show up. That peak doesn't show up. So it's not going to be perfectly periodic. There's going to be a little defect from the wrapping around, from 2 to the n to 0. So how are we going to deal with that? Well, I won't go through the arithmetic, but basically, if little n is large enough, which means large enough relative to R, then after the Fourier transform, we get something that is peaked. So remember, in the perfectly periodic case, we got stuff that was peaked exactly at multiples of 2 to the n over r. And in this case, we'll get stuff that's pretty highly peaked, near 2 to the n over r. So we get things that are highly peaked. And it's going to be near 2 to the n over r, sorry, multiples of. And of course, it can't be peaked exactly at 2 to the n over r, because 2 to the n over r is not an integer. But more than that, there's also some kind of little bit of noise due to the fact that it's not perfectly periodic. So it'll look something like this. You know, there'll be some big thing like this, and then some low-level noise, and some more, another big narrow peak like that. Etc. Right? And somewhere in here will be 2 to the n over r, and in here will be 2 times 2 to the n over r, and here will be 3 times 2 to the n over r, and 4 times 2 to the n over r, and so on. Okay? And this, of course, is just a kind of smoothing out of what we actually have, because what we actually have is discrete values. And it might be that there's one value that's very large, and then two values around that are kind of smaller. Or maybe if this is right, you know, like near a half, an integer plus a half, maybe there's two values that are pretty large, and then some more around that are smaller and smaller. Okay? But the point is that when we measure, with very high probability, we'll get something that's near a multiple of 2 to the n over r. So in order to make this work, so how large could n be? And it turns out that picking n to be kind of on the order of n squared is right. So what that means in these calculations is that this step, so what's sorry, not n on the order of n squared, 2 to the n on the order of n squared. If little n was on the order of n squared, then it would take really, really long. So what that means is that things that depend on little n, that's 2 log n, right? Which for order notation is just enough to say it's log n. So the Fourier transform takes O of log n squared gates, and Markov exponentiation takes log n cubed gates. So that's why the Markov exponentiation is the time-limiting step, and Schwarz algorithm takes O of log n cubed gates. And you can speed that up using fast multiplication. And I guess the best fast multiplication algorithms will bring that down to O of n squared log n log log n. Okay. And I guess for little n, you can substitute log big N, if you like. But that would be too many logs at this point. Okay. So, so then we get some integer, and B is close to C times 2 to the n over R. Okay, in other words, B over 2 to the n is about C over R. And we want to find C over R. And in particular, if we do this, you know, a couple of times, we can find the C that's relatively prime to R. And then finding C over R tells us R. Okay. You can do even a little better if you find two things that are each not relatively prime, but have kind of different shared divisors with R. So you don't really need to do this very many times before you get enough information. But you still have to find C over R first. So how do we do that? So this is a little bit of magic. I don't have a good intuition for why this works. You need to know maybe more number theory to appreciate it. But the way to do it is pretty straightforward. So so B over 2 to the n is close to C over R. And what you do is you use what's called the continued fraction expansion. So we know B over 2 to the n, so we can write the continued fraction expansion for that. So what that is it says that this is equal to something of this form. Well, maybe I should call this something else. So I used it here already. F0 plus 1 over F1 plus 1 over F2 plus 1 over F3 plus dot, dot, dot. Okay? And you can keep on doing this. And every time in the denominator, you take another value. So you can find this by just saying, well, we'll take this. If it's greater than 1, we can get an F0 term. And if not, then we subtract off the F0 term. We get another fraction. We invert it. What we get is probably now going to be greater than 1 because it was less than 1 before. And then you get F1 term the same way, and just recursively do that. Okay? And because this is a rational number, this will terminate. And it turns out, if you stop early at some point, you get exactly C over R. And in order for this to work, C over R needs to be close enough to be over 2 to the n. Like I said, I have no intuition at all as to why this happens. But maybe somebody who knows more number theory could tell us that. But it works. Of course, you don't know exactly where to stop. But the nice thing is that you can test it, right? Because you can just try stopping in various places and see whether what that gives you in terms of C over R, whether that's something plausible, right? R you can test. You can take your value to the rth power and see if it gets 1. And if not, then you know it's not right. If it does get 1, then it may still not be right, because it could be, say, a factor of R. But you know, you can always then go forward and take R over 2 and see if that works. If it does, you can do this thing we did yesterday and find the factors. If not, then maybe you have to go to a different value of the continued fraction. But actually, this whole thing, you don't need to go to very far before it terminates. So it's this is a modest cost compared to the marginal computation. OK? So obviously, I haven't gone into all the details of this, but this is how you make for a number. OK? So that's Schur's algorithm. Are there questions on that?
I don't really have an intuitive understanding of what's happening.
At this last part, you mean? Or the earlier part?
No, I mean, an overall, I guess, but that's something.
Right. OK, so the overall understanding is mostly captured by this picture. OK? The idea is that we're trying to extract information about the period. OK? So we have a periodic function. So we generate something that's periodic in amplitude, a state that's periodic, and then use the Fourier transform to extract the periods. That's the big picture. And then, you know, this part and this part is just details of how to do the intermediate calculations, the marginal exponentiation and the Fourier transform. And this part is just all details of the fact that we don't get a perfectly periodic state. Okay? I mean, this is an important detail because it involves, you know, quantum circuitry. The other ones, I think, are not so important. This is really where all the main idea is. Okay? Okay. So if there are no other questions, then I will start on a different algorithm. Ready? Okay. So I don't know. Maybe I should say make one farewell comment about Schur's algorithm now that I've erased it. I mean, I told you yesterday how factoring was connected with RSA, but maybe it's worth just putting that together explicitly. RSA is widely used today, and the reason it's widely used is because we think that factoring is hard, a hard problem to solve. Okay, but that means if people built quantum computers, then RSA would no longer be secure. And this would have a big practical impact because, well, either that means that a lot of people would be using insecure cryptography, or we'd have to change all the cryptography built into, you know, the web and a lot of other encryption systems that are in actual use today. OK? So that's kind of a big practical impact. Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, so the way I've described it to you, you need little n for the Fourier transform, and then you need some to store the marginal exponentiation. which was, about log big N. So little n is about 2 log of big N. So that's about 3 log of big N, which is not that, it's not that many in terms of classical computation. If you use, if you're talking 1,000-bit numbers, then that's 3,000 bits. On a quantum computer, 3,000 qubits is actually a lot, given that we can do maybe 10 now. But it's not totally unreasonable. What's a little more restrictive is the number of operations you need to do. If you go for this, then 1,000 cubed is 10 to the ninth, which is starting to be a lot. That's already big enough that actually it's better to use maybe not the best fast multiplication tricks, but some intermediate ones. So maybe millions of operations, which is still a long ways away from happening, but is not. It's hard to predict, right, where the technology will go. We'll talk some next week about implementations of quantum computing. It's not unimaginable. Certainly, regular computers can do that kind of calculation easily. And in fact, just to use RSA, you have to do this kind of modular exponentiation. They do some tricks so that it's a bit easier. They pick E specially so that you don't have to do as much work. But basically, breaking RSA on a quantum computer requires roughly as many steps as using it does on a classical computer. Okay, so let's move on to Grover's algorithm.
Sorry, one other
question. Yeah.
Do there exist then similar algorithms from, like, say, your discrete logarithm or ETC?
Good question. Okay, so actually, Shor's original paper gave algorithms for factoring and for discrete log.
Okay.
So the discrete log algorithm is closely related to the factoring algorithm. It's a little more complicated, so I didn't want to do it. It turns out actually basically the same kind of algorithm, same general class of algorithm, works also for elliptic curve cryptography. They're all based, roughly speaking, on some generalization of period finding. Obviously, I didn't want to go into elliptic curve cryptography because that's a whole mathematical structure that is not really related to anything else in the class. So it's not going to do that. But Nielsen and Klang has a description of the discrete log algorithm.
Right.
Elliptic curves, actually, I've never even looked at it myself, so I'm not sure where a good place to do that. But if you kind of look at the appropriate generalization of this, which is called the abelian hidden subgroup problem, then the elliptic curve cryptography apparently falls into that class. I'm not sure discrete log is technically in that class, but it's related anyway. But factoring certainly is, or order finding. Okay. So for this next algorithm, it's going to be of a very different character than Shor's algorithm. It's kind of much more widely applicable. Shor's algorithm has a big practical impact because it impacts RSA, but most people don't really need to factor things. But this next algorithm is useful for a huge variety of algorithms that you run. The problem is it's not an exponential speedup. Shor's algorithm took us from something that's exponential in little n to something that's polynomial in little n. This will take us from something that's basically exponential in the number of qubits to the square root of that. But that's still very useful, because if you're doing a really big algorithm, then reducing the number of operations to the square root is a big improvement, right? It's the difference between 10 to the 10th operations and 10 to the 5th operations. And there's some constant factors, so that's not totally fair, but roughly speaking. Okay? So in particular, this problem is called the unstructured search problem. Or sometimes database search. And the specific description of it is as an oracle problem. So the oracle problem is we have some oracle, and either O of x is equal to 0, or this is for all x, or O of x, or not. And we'd like to know which one. And in particular, we want to find some value x0 such that O of x0 is equal to 1. So the oracle, I should say, maps, let's put it the set 1 through big N to 0, 1. OK? And sometimes this element x0 is referred to as a marked element. So that's kind of the idea. We have this huge set of things, and we have one or maybe a few marked elements. And we'd like to find a marked element. So this is kind of a finding a needle in a haystack problem. You have a big haystack. There's a small number of needles. You need to look through each of the pieces of hay to find the needle. Okay. So why is this an interesting problem? Well, because it represents a search where we don't know any additional information. Right? If we have additional information, maybe we can use that to do something better. But if we don't, we can still do this, right? Or if we don't want to use the additional information. So for instance, this can represent a generic NP complete problem. In that case, these different possible inputs are the different possible witnesses. Right? If you have, like, for instance, satisfiability, these different possible things represent, these input values represent the different assignments of variables, of all n variables, all little n variables for the SAT formula. And then this represents whether the verification succeeds or fails. So in other words, this says whether the formula is satisfiable or not satisfiable. One, I guess, would be satisfiable. And then the marked element would be a satisfying assignment. Okay? And the idea is that NP complete problems, they're the hardest problems in NP. They certainly have some internal structure, but we don't really know how to use it. Right? So for at least some NP complete problems, it seems like the best algorithms we know are not a whole lot better than just testing every possible input. And or every possible witness, I should say. And so that's what this oracle problem represents. Classically, it's a problem where, in order to find the marked elements, you basically have no option except to try every possible input until you find one. Okay. All right, let me write that down here. So classically, to find a marked element, we need O of big N queries. And that's because whenever we ask a query, the information we get tells us nothing about any of the other inputs. So it's worth mentioning that this can also represent other searches, not just NP complete. And you can use an algorithm that works for database search will work for really any search if you're willing to throw away any additional information you have. Okay. Now, obviously, this might not be a winning thing to do if you have a lot of additional information that really is going to help you search. In some cases, you can still, you know, do something clever and still apply get a similar kind of speed up. But sometimes, just kind of the brute force improvement or some just small variation is going to still get you a big speed up over what you could do even with this additional information. And on the homework problem, there are also some examples of these types of searches that you can that you'll try to figure out how to apply this Grover's algorithm to. Okay. So so the algorithm, the quantum algorithm, uses only O of square root of n queries in general, depending a bit on how many solutions there are. And it's called Grover's algorithm. It's named after Love Grover, who's the discoverer. So kind of the intuition here, classically, well, unintuition, classically, well, we could do it systematically, right? We could look at input 1, and then input 2, and then input 3. But it's just as good if we just choose the inputs at random, right? There's no order here. This order is just for convenience. It doesn't really mean anything. And if we choose them at random, well, then the probability each time, if there's only one marked element, then each time we search, each time we query, we have a probability of 1 over n of getting the right one. And then when we do a second one, we have another probability of 1 over n. And the third one, another probability of 1 over n, right? And these probabilities add up. So if we try 3 separate numbers, then probability 3 over n. And if we try 1,000, then it's 1,000 over n, if we're, you know, careful not to ask the same question twice, OK? But because the probability started so small, 1 over n, we have to do order n queries before the probability adds up to a reasonable number, say a probability of a half, of finding that marked element. In the quantum case, we have some quantumness available, right? And maybe we can ask queries in superpositions using the quantum oracle. And in that case, we have not just probabilities, we have amplitudes. And remember, the amplitude then of the marked element is 1 over square root of n. And so the intuition is that we can get, as we ask more and more queries, instead of adding up the probabilities, we can add up these amplitudes. And so in that case, we would only need about square root of n queries to get a large amplitude. Of the correct answer. Oh, it can be marked down, I guess. OK? Let's see. It's probably not worth going on from here today. So I can tell you the algorithm tomorrow, which means we're finishing a few minutes early, unless there are some questions. Yeah? This is just an intuition, okay? The point is, we're going to do. I mean, hopefully it'll be clearer tomorrow. But the idea is we're going to have to do some sort of quantum rotation that's going to kind of let the amplitude from our first try add up coherently with the amplitude for the second try. Again, this is just an intuition. It's not even that precise in intuition. So it's hard to go from that statement to an actual algorithm. But I'm just trying to give you at least at some level a reason why you maybe shouldn't be too surprised that we get this square root of n out of this. Since we have a few minutes, does everyone understand kind of how, if you have this algorithm, you can use it, say, to speed up the solution of an NP-complete problem? Was that clear? I talked about it, but I didn't really do it in detail. Maybe I should do that. OK, so in that case, remember, so for an NP-complete problem, X is a witness, possible witness. And then O of X is the verification function. Which checks whether the witness is accepted. So if we have an n-bit witness, then big N is equal to 2 to the little n. Okay, and in this case, O of X, well, we know how to explicitly compute it. But again, because it's an NP-complete problem, this is an example of something where it's easy to calculate the output, but it's hard to go backwards from that and calculate a possible input. Yeah.
Polynomially with the size of the
input. Right. Usually, I mean, because you know it's an NP-complete problem, the size of the witness that you use is actually just kind of fixed by the size of the input. Okay. It doesn't have to be the case, right. But usually.
But in any case, so you could have little n is the number of bits in the input.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have O to the little n, things to check.
Well, the witness could be polynomially bigger, right? So if the size of the input, yeah. Yeah. Right.
Like poly n times 2 to the poly n.
Right.
But probably the poly n factor at the beginning like drops out.
Well, like, yeah, that's dominated by just, you know, making it 2 to the... to the slightly larger.
Oh, okay. Okay. So ultimately,
I mean, if you get 2 to the polynomial and multiply by 2,
yeah.
That's already, well, I guess, sorry, it's a multiplicative. So, but yes, 2 to the.
Okay. Yeah. So ultimately, any NP problem has an algorithm which is no worse than 2 to the poly n.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And that was implicit in the picture I showed you before, maybe even explicit, I forget what I said, with the complexity classifier where we had P. And we had NP, and then we had X. And NP was inside X.
Uh-huh. OK, so this allows us, like, we can modify the worst case algorithm. So instead of running in 2 to the poly n,
right.
It runs in 2 to the square root of?
No, it's square root of 2 to the poly n, which is still 2 to the poly n, unfortunately. But it's a smaller polynomial.
Right, OK.
OK.
This works. If our current algorithm is a worst case algorithm, basically, like this will speed it up. But like, what if we have a slightly better than worst case algorithm?
Right. Well, it depends how much slightly better. If it's noticeably better. So for instance, the best factoring algorithms. Obviously, we have a good quantum factoring algorithm. The best factoring algorithms are quite substantially better than searching all primes.
Okay.
And so this would not be a useful speed up for that.
Yeah.
Obviously, we can use Schrodinger's algorithm, which is in fact useful to you. But for some other problems, really, you can't do enough better than exhaustive search. And like I said, there's also some cases where you can use some tricks and combine kind of a clever search with Schrodinger's algorithm to do even better.
So it's currently the case that Is it currently the case that no NP-complete problem can be solved using a better method than exhaustive search?
No, I don't think that's the case.
Okay.
Certainly, one thing that's true is a lot of NP-complete problems you can approximate the answer. So not that you can't use a decision problem, obviously. Yeah. But like, for instance, if you have satisfiability and you want to say, well, I don't need to satisfy everything, but I'd like to satisfy as many clauses as possible.
Yeah.
Actually, that one you can't approximate very well. But there are other, but you kind of get the notion of how well you can do, right, by saying how many clauses you can get to. And there are some other NP-complete problems which you can approximate very well, even with a polynomial time algorithm. So there's a wide range. To prove that different problems are NP-complete, you have to get reduction from one of them to another. But these reductions don't necessarily preserve these properties like approximability or you know what actually the best algorithm is, because there could be a polynomial blow-up which could cancel kind of the improvements that you get from a slightly better algorithm.
Okay.
And the point is that to do the reduction, you might take a problem of size n and reduce it to a problem of size n squared.
Right.
Okay. And so maybe for the first one, you had an algorithm that was 2 to the n over 5. But that's not going to help when you've increased the size to the n squared, or the size n squared. So that type of thing. So every one is different in this particular case. Okay. And then tomorrow we'll finish Grover Douglas, or start Grover Douglas.